Welcome to Night School, taking a stab at the Middle Ages.
A podcast devoted to medieval history and culture, and the occasional bad pun.
I'm Becca, bringing you everything related to medieval religion and church history.
And I'm Claire, covering all things medieval literature and history.
Hey guys, welcome back. Today we're going to do a mini-sode episode on maps of the medieval world. So it's going to be a little shorter than our last episode on medieval childhood. If you tuned in on that one, it was quite long. So today we're going to talk about medieval cartography.
Becca and I picked three to kind of spotlight and go into more detail on. So I'm going to do the Catalan Atlas and also the Tabula Rogeriana from different parts of the world. And Becca, you are going to give an intro on Mapamundi, and what else?
And then I'm going to kind of go into detail on the Hereford Mapamundi and kind of talk about its religious iconography and its representation of Western Christian perceptions of the world. So I guess we could just dive right into some background on Mapamundi in general. So Mapamundi is a term used to describe the nearly 4,000 extant medieval European maps we have today. And although the term translates from Latin to cloth of the world, Mapamundi were also created on a variety of different mediums, most often on vellum, which of course is calfskin, or on parchment, but they were also depicted as frescoes and mosaics, or in manuscripts, encyclopedias, or standalone maps like the Hereford Mapamundi, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But a little bit about where they might be displayed. They were often in courts of English monarchs, in houses of lay elites, or maybe in monasteries and cathedral schools. Regardless of the setting, though, possession of one symbolically conveyed the power, wealth, and worldliness of the owner. So it was kind of a symbol of, I guess, prestige and wealth to own one. And many of the Mapamundi adopted a TO orientation. So basically, if you can imagine, the world is drawn as a large circle with a T shape inside, where the top of the T is the diameter of the circle. And then Asia is depicted as the top half, whereas in the bottom, Europe and Africa are equally divided on the left and right side, respectively. And this configuration had precedence in Greco-Roman geography. But in the Middle Ages, it was kind of justified through biblical exegesis on Genesis, which interpreted Noah's sons Shem, Ham, and Japheth to have been bestowed these three continents after the Great Flood in the Bible. And this reading is also evident in medieval texts such as the mid-14th century Book of John Mandeville and others.
By the way, if you haven't already, go to our WordPress and look at our medieval memes. Yes. You'll find Sir John Mandeville there. Okay, continue.
Okay. But I think it's important to note that this isn't the only way medieval folks saw the world, right? So there were different variations among Mapamundi. For example, Jocelyn Wogan Brown is a scholar who talks a bit about this, and she describes how some maps would also divide the world into parallel zones depending on climate and habitation. Whereas quadripartite maps include a fourth continent of the antipodes in the southern hemisphere to kind of represent the unknown parts of the world, which Western Christians sought to missionize. So I think it's definitely important to note that Mapamundi also orientalized the other peoples of the East, how they would kind of group them together collectively and things like that. And they would also depict them perhaps sometimes with distorted physiognomy, and this was also supported sometimes in the work of theologians and scholars. So, for example, Augustine of Hippo argued that peoples of these regions were not part of the human race, and they weren't descended from Adams and were monstrous and things like that. So I think it's important to note that these kind of maps can also have derogatory worldviews on other groups and peoples that weren't part of these three main continents that they're discussing and depicting. And in addition to that, Mapamundi were initially criticized by cartography historians because they obviously depicted world geography inaccurately. And although medieval sailors and merchants would own more geographically accurate maps, I think it's interesting to note, like, Mapamundi are still significant because they help us understand how Western Christian societies kind of read the world in a symbolic way and how it's kind of a cultural reflection of that. And I think this is most evident in the Hereford Mapamundi, where geography and religious symbolism very clearly collide. So the Hereford Mapamundi is the largest surviving complete Mapamundi. It's painted on a single sheet of vellum or calfskin, and it measures just over 5 feet high and 4 feet wide. Scholars Malcolm Parks and Nigel Morgan suggest it was likely created between 1290 and 1310. And luckily for art historians, the map actually has an inscription. So we know that it's attributed to the work of Richard of Haldingham or Lafford, which is in modern day Haldingham and Sleaford in Lincolnshire. And the map was actually originally a triptych. So it was enclosed in this wooden oak frame with folding doors. And we only have the central panel today, but there's a sketch by artist John Carter from 1784, which actually revealed to scholars that the inside of the folding doors had iconography of the Annunciation. So the Virgin Mary and angel, the angel Gabriel are depicted. There's also a really interesting article by Thomas de Wesselo. He talks about how the map was originally displayed and kind of its meaning. So it was originally hung in the south choir aisle of the cathedral at Hereford Cathedral, and it was part of the current bishop at the time, Bishop Richard Swinfeld. It was part of his campaign to kind of make the cathedral an important pilgrimage destination, because at the time he was kind of working towards the canonization of his predecessor, Bishop Thomas Cantalupe. So I think it's important just to note kind of the context of why the map was made and why it was used at the cathedral. And the map itself has a really interesting history because it survived over 700 years of kind of harsh conditions. So, for example, it was hidden during the Protestant Reformation. It endured two rounds of restoration by conservators at the British Museum in 1855 and in the 1940s, both of which actually damaged the map. And it was even hidden in a coal mine near Bradford-on-Avon during World War II. So the map is still really beautiful today, but it's kind of hard to get a sense of how contemporary medieval pilgrims would have perceived the map, because at the time it was really vibrant. It has many gold illuminations and bright colors. And there's actually a website for the map itself, which displays it in kind of an enhanced color feature, which I would recommend checking out.
Are you talking about the one that you can like click on and zoom in and it will tell you like random things about it?
Yeah, it like zooms into individual pictures and portions of the map, and it even has like little blurb explanations for kind of the symbolism. So
before this, I looked it up and I clicked on it, and the first thing I clicked on was a little elephant drawing.
Yeah.
I was like, this is just amazing. Yeah.
About like the bestiaries and like,
yeah,
that's Adam and Eve and all. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely recommend. But overall, the map itself has over 500 drawings, and it really interestingly combines realistic geography, or at least loosely realistic geography, with mythology, legends, religious iconography, and ancient thought. It also portrays a lot of biblical stories. So, for example, the Garden of Eden is depicted and Adam and Eve's expulsion from there, as well as the Exodus of the Israelites is mapped out. So it just has a lot of interesting depictions of biblical stories. I think another important thing to highlight is that Jerusalem appears at the center of Hereford Mapamundi's imagined world. So this was kind of, although not a universal idea, it was kind of commonly depicted in texts and sometimes in maps, this idea of Jerusalem as the center of the world. And scholar Ian Higgins notes that the precedence was set by biblical exegesis on Ezekiel by St. Jerome as early as the 5th century. And he actually influenced Isidore of Sevilla in his 7th century famous encyclopedia Etymology, which included its own TO-shaped map of Mundi. So Christian imaginations of Jerusalem's centrality as the center of the world and of Christian life really had deeply apocalyptic and kind of eschatological meaning, of course, because this is the city where Jesus was believed to be crucified and where people believe that the second coming would occur. And, you know, apocalyptic millennialism and kind of eschatological hopes are kind of a big part of the medieval Christian tradition. And life, death, and salvation are key symbols of the map's kind of overall religious iconography. So, for example, around the globe in Latin, the Latin word for death is spelled out in four gilded capital letters, M-O-R-S. And above the map, near its rounded apex, the map depicts the entire judgment scene. So Christ appears enthroned in heaven and is displaying his wounds of the crucifixion. Mary's shown at his feet interceding for mankind. And there's angels, you know, on the right-hand side opening the gates of heaven to a queue of souls, whereas on the left, the gates are closed to sinners who are bound together and led by a demon to kind of this gaping dragon-like mouth, which is supposed to represent hell. And this is kind of a commonly used method to depict hell in the Middle Ages, because contemporaries kind of envisioned hell as like being devoured by a beast. So yeah, that's just a little bit of interesting iconography. So as you can tell, basically from just a little bit of description about some of the religious iconography, the map has a lot of interesting symbolism. So this isn't just a map kind of in the modern sense that just portrays strictly geography, right? It's really a visual encyclopedia of Christian iconography and symbolism, as well as the classical heritage and the knowledge of this tradition which it inherited. So it really summarizes, you know, different religious beliefs, history, as well as knowledge about the natural world. And it's more, I guess you could call it like a visual storybook, because it shows kind of accurate history as well as mythological history and biblical history.
I think that it's going to be interesting to compare it to the two maps that I'm going to talk about, because they were produced in different parts of the world. So it'll be interesting to see whether or not, or measure how much religion or theology ties into the maps I'm talking about compared to what you just said, because there are definitely some cool contrasts, but also similarities. So I think it'll be interesting.
All right. Well, do you want to take us away on your maps, Claire?
Sure. I'm going to start off by taking us on a journey to Norman Sicily and talk about the Tabula Rogeriana. In the mid-12th century, Norman Sicily was a very lively place of trade and travel, and it sat between the Latin Christian territory to the north and west and the Muslim world to the south. And Norman King Roger II did demonstrate a sort of religious tolerance that encouraged multicultural exchange, and he did welcome the highly skilled Arabic cartographer Al-Idrisi to his court, which is who created the Tabula Rogeriana. However, Francisco Bethencourt reminds us in his book that although the cultures reflected in various art forms in Norman Sicily were very diverse because of the multicultural exchange, it didn't really reach or characterize the typologies of all humankind, although you might assume while looking at it. It consisted of and characterized only peoples controlled by Roger II, and kind of reflected his imperial ambitions too, which I think was really interesting. And scholars have suggested that Al-Idrisi produced the richest source of geographical work from the Middle Ages, just because of how detailed the commentary was, which I'll get to in a second. But he was a very acclaimed cartographer, born around 1100 in the North African city Sabta, which is now, I think you pronounce it Ceuta, Spain. And he received his education in Cordoba, a part of Islamic Spain, and also traveled all over North Africa, Asia Minor, and Europe. So he was very traveled. When he created his maps, he did draw and calculate from his own personal experiences. So Roger II did commission him to create maps of the entire known world to display at his court. And once he finished a bunch of drafts of atlases, Roger II instructed him to inscribe his map onto a large piece of silver. And records do show that Aladrisi did complete this ambitious task, but the piece did not survive the centuries because the inscriptions just didn't last on silver, which I really wish we could see what it looked like because it would have been really interesting. Mm-hmm. However, what did survive, though, were 70 regional maps with extensive commentary in both Latin and Arabic. And this is what is referred to as the Tabula Rogeriana, and it's called Kitab Rujar in Arabic, but some of the English names are a diversion for the man longing to travel far off places, or entertainment for those wanting to discover the world, which I don't know why. Those are just really cool names.
Yeah.
So a lot of names, but in making the map, Aladrisi consulted books and travel reports through a synthesis of classical Latin and Arabic sources. So kind of like what you were saying about the Hereford map, like a lot of different corners of knowledge kind of intersecting into one. Right. It's like a visual manifestation of all of those synthesized knowledge. But he also interviewed travelers and traders who came to Sicily about where they had come from and what they had seen. And he basically just records their responses. And that also influenced his drawings because, you know, they could have been traveling from a place that he might not have been before.
Sure.
Something else to note is that Aladrisi abandoned the traditional Muslim mechanics of drawing abstract and highly stylized maps of the Islamic world.
Mm.
And these traditional Muslim drawings usually lacked exact precise coordinates and was more abstract, kind of like artistic.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead he adopted the ways of the Greek mathematician Ptolemy from the 2nd century.
Yeah.
And calculated geographical coordinates of exact locations. And like Ptolemy, Aladrisi's maps were divided into 7 climates depending on latitude. And also, even though his maps and atlases that were in the Tabula Rogeriana were flat, Aladrisi's own commentary and measurements do suggest that the Earth's roundness went unquestioned during this time period, because he actually, in the commentary, it's really interesting to see, he calculates the world's like circumference as a sphere. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I'll include a picture of it, but yeah. Okay, so we were just in 12th century Norman Sicily with Aladrisi, but now we're going to transition to talk about the Catalan Atlas, which was created in 14th century Mallorca by Cresc Abraham, born of a Jewish family of unknown origin. And this map was a striking combination of a sea chart and Mapamundi. It's really interesting to look at the sea chart if you go to our Twitter or our WordPress and look at the images.
Yes.
But, yeah. But I did want to give a little outline of what was going on in Mallorca at the time before we talk about the map. So Mallorca became a possession of the crown of Aragon / Catalunya in the 13th century as an important source of revenue and kind of, I don't know, prestige for the Aragonese crown.
Mm-hmm.
And Mallorca was actually in a very, I guess, strategic location that made it an emporium of people throughout the Mediterranean and Northern Europe. So kind of like what we saw in Norman Sicily, it's kind of like just a bunch of different people from all over kind of intersecting their religions and beliefs and exchanging goods from different parts of the world. So it was kind of a common point for European and African traders with commercial intentions to come and mingle together. But going back to the Atlas itself, it survives in its version dedicated to King Charles V in France. And as we know about Charles V, he had a very extensive collection of books and art. So that's his version that we have to look at. And it was produced on the island of Mallorca in the 1370s. A lot of people suggest that it was 1375, but there's no precise dating to indicate that, but in most things I read, it said 1375, so we're just going to go with that. And the atlas was likely produced in a workshop of skilled technicians and illustrators under Kresk's supervision, just because of how intricate it was and, like, the speed of which it was produced. And kind of going, comparing it back to the Hereford map,
mm-hmm.
this one kind of mixed realism and accuracy, but it served more of a realistic purpose of calculations instead of a theological or allegorical purpose. However, there is still an illustration of the Antichrist,
mm-hmm.
and a big portion of the map, like, fighting off
like Christ versus Antichrist.
Yeah.
Apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so it represents the world as it was known to Europeans in those days, and it includes the Canary Islands to China, and like the Tabula Ruggieriana, it does reflect imperial ambitions of the time in the Mediterranean, and kind of going along with some of the imperial ambitions that were represented in the map. Usually, a lot of times, Francisco Bethencourt notes this in the wonderful book, Racisms from the Middle Ages to the 20th Century, that descriptions of territories and their cartographic representations of the people, like, went hand in hand with each other. So, like, if one area was known to have a mass amount of, like, gold, or, like, they were really involved in, like, the trade industry and gold, then usually, like, the king would be depicted as holding gold, having a gold crown on, surrounded by gold, things like that.
Okay.
And the majority of Muslim rulers are drawn with white skin, accompanied by other symbolic markers of alterity, such as headdresses, usually elaborate clothing, and also surrounded by animals, which kind of goes back to Becca with what you were saying of kind of how the other was characterized. And a lot of times, if cartographers didn't really have knowledge of a specific group of people, they would either generalize and make them appear as another type of people that they were more familiar with, or they would just totally exoticize them without like real knowledge of what they looked like. So I think it's important to also note that the people portrayed on the map more often than not were either dramatized or not as realistic as one might originally think when looking at the map, just because of how detailed it is.
Right.
Other things to note about the map, the introductory panels. So the map is kind of split up into panels. It's a very big map, as you will see in the pictures, but the introduction kind of explains the origins of the physical universe, and it does record 14th century knowledge and wisdom on matters pertaining to cosmology, astronomy, astrology, and meteorology. And it does include in the commentary important travel accounts of others, such as Marco Polo's voyages in Asia.
Okay, well, I'm glad we were able to kind of cover these three. It's just a snapshot of kind of the multitude of medieval maps that we could talk about, but I guess we just wanted this to kind of be an introduction to them.
Yeah, I would say that while you did learn about three maps from us, don't just stop there. Even if you go on, like, if you type in medieval maps of the world, like, so many more will pop up than these three. We didn't represent all of what was created in the medieval world, but we kind of just, like, dipped our toes in, I guess.
Yeah, no, exactly. But, of course, as always, we'll publish a reading list and the sources we used with our episode recap on the WordPress in case you guys do want to read more. And we have some exciting episodes coming up. Claire, do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in these upcoming weeks, our episode for next week is on Marjorie Kemp, and Professor Diane Watt from the University of Surrey will be on kind of talking with us, and we're going to ask her some questions about Marjorie and kind of her status in the 14th century. So it'll be interesting. And yeah, just we have a lot of other scholars lined up, so just stay tuned.